Hi, it's Mind Rolling, and today I have with me Mitch Ablett. And Mitch wrote a book called The Five Hurdles to Happiness and the Mindful Path to Overcoming Them. I might get some feedback going, only five? There might be 100 in my life,
Yeah.
The cool thing. Welcome, Mitch. Let's start.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Mitch is a. You're a therapist, but a psychiatrist, I believe.
Psychologist.
Okay.
Yep.
And well steeped in Buddhism, and so the reason, and I just told this to Mitch, the particular thrust that he has in this book is so much akin to the kinds of things we talk about and the people we talk to on Mind Rolling, getting down to the very practical, down-to-earth ways to understand some of this stuff. And of course, we love the Buddhist psychology, basically. And what, just tell us a little bit about how you even became aware and went, okay, wait, there is something else other than everything that I've been habituated to since I came into this world, and there might be a way to get free. How did that work for you?
I think it was out of mostly my, at the time, professional desperation as a psychologist and working with really acute folks. I had worked in residential care as a therapist, mostly with kids with really significant like trauma and behavioral issues. And, in my last job that I was at for over a decade, I was the clinical director of a therapeutic school for kids with school age kids with emotional behavioral challenges. And so not only was I a therapist, I was the boss of the therapist. And so then I was charged with helping take care of my staff as they dealt with all this intensity. And yet I wasn't fully taking care of myself. I started to notice all these patterns that felt old, that were reactive in response to the stress and the, basically the fear. And that led me to start following up on some things that I had first learned when I was at a previous job, and I heard Steve Hayes, one of the co-founders of Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, which is a mindfulness-based psychotherapy. I heard him speak at a conference, and I got really curious, as before I was really much of a meditator at all. And so through the back door, and instead of a Dharma path or a contemplative tradition originally, it was as a provider, as a therapist, I learned about this mindfulness-based therapy. And then I quickly realized that if I'm going to help others, and if I'm going to help myself and my staff, I've got to really turn this on myself.
Mm.
And I have to really explore it myself. And that led to my own, my own path, my own journey with meditation. So, it's kind of a different path from a lot of people. I don't think I'm alone. I think there are many people that had scoffed at mindfulness. I remember being given a copy of Jon Kabat-Zinn's Wherever You Go, There You Are when I was in grad school. And I remember looking at it and like, what the hell is this? And kind of chucking it on to the side and then coming back to it later and actually encountering it. I think it's the professional stuff around helping myself, helping others. And then I quickly realized that in order to really be a decent therapist, I had to get with my own patterns, and particularly the fear and anger and, basically all of these five, we call hurdles on the cover, but are the traditional Buddhist psychology hindrances to awareness.
And you seem to have steeped yourself as well in Buddhism. And there's so many different attributions here from different texts that you've obviously read. So it does go beyond just mindfulness.
Yes. And
the other thing that it does that's lovely and makes this book, you want to keep reading it, and it's not just, okay, here's what to do, is your own experience and the stories. I love those.
Thank you. Yeah. I think I was inspired in terms of writing and speaking, Jack Kornfield's work and how he teaches. And I haven't met him personally. I've talked on the phone with his wife a few times when my previous role as the executive director of the Institute for Meditation and Psychotherapy, and she's on the board. Trudy. I've read most of Jack's books and the way he uses storytelling, and Nasruddin is one of his favorites, as is mine. And I this as a therapist, people have always seemed to resonate most through story.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody. Well, he's a great model, Jack, for sure. For sure. Well, hey, right off the bat, as soon as I started reading the book, the very first story I could relate with big time.
Okay.
And I'd love for you, I'm sure you remember, but it's about your out-of-control six-year-old, that story. And tell that story. Let's start there, because it's wonderful.
Yeah, and it's an ongoing, unfolding story. Oh, She's now eight.
Yeah.
She's, as all parents think of their kids, she's amazing, super sweet and sensitive. And has this intuitive, deep feeling and knowing to her, which is awesome. The other side of that sword is how deeply she feels and can suffer. And, formally, she was diagnosed several years ago with obsessive compulsive disorder. And, so back even just a couple years ago, when I started writing this book, we were still in the throes. It's much more resolved and stabilized now. In no small part due to the work my wife and I have done about our own stuff, which this book was a part of that, which was very helpful. But she could really, when she got triggered with the anxiety, if we in any way at the time tried to block one of her compulsive rituals, which at the time might be copying, her children's books over and over again. And if we tried to, get her to stop doing that, she would lash out aggressively. And then, so I start the book with a story that, I had to restrain my out of control 6-year old today. And all that not only was showing up in her that I could witness, but then more importantly, and in terms of practice, what was showing up in me, and the anger and the resentment, the mind tape of, here we go again, she's doing this to us, to me, and kind of that velcroing of the mind, thought to the body, saying, I can't have this, and I got to push it off, which took the form of physically holding her. Yes, her body was out of control, but it was also me feeling out of control and trying to get that control back and push away the conditioning that I didn't want to experience. So.
Mm. Yeah, and then, of course, you have the other things that are concomitant to that, which is guilt feelings and so on, and then watching yourself, that awareness factor comes in, and you can see how you're playing out these past habitual patterns and so on.
Yes.
So it's a great start that everybody can absolutely relate to. I mean, I was like, oh Jesus, yes, this, how many times has that happened to me? And
right,
oh my Lord. Yeah. And talk about you do talk about karma in this book, which is a subject that we're really, as part of the Be Here Now Network, investigating with Jack and Sharon and Joseph and others. But it just strikes me when you were talking about you and your wife have this child, and you are going through whatever you are going through with her karmic predilections, and then they're bumping into yours and causing you to dig deeper to find the place where, as you said about your co-workers and people that work for you, you need to fix yourself here so that you can help anybody, which is, you know, this is a famous thing of Ram Dass. There's nothing you can do as a therapist, as social action, nothing until you fix your own self, fix
That's
your
right.
heart, then you can share. So,
right.
yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's I can't remember the exact phrase I use in the book, but you know, karma seems to be the as a term, particularly here in the West, it's like the you know, the black sheep, the last one to get called to, you know, to play at recess on the team. You know, it's like, yeah, it seems kind of a taboo thing, and it has all this baggage, but it's, you know, in my mind, it's really straightforward. It doesn't have to necessarily be about anything beyond the realm of physics. In fact, it's conditioning, and it's genetics and conditioning, and these patterns that show up in us. And if we relate to it mindlessly, then the conditioning just rolls. It just continues when the context cues it. Yeah. So you don't have to get threatened by the concept. It doesn't have to be about anything mystical per se.
Yeah.
And as a psychologist, as a therapist, I'm dealing with karma every day. And it's the, like you said, the bumping up against of my client's karma, their conditioning, with my own. And then all I, you know, what I do when I intervene is I relate to it with them and create a field where, are we willing to open to this conditioning, and then choose what to do with our awareness, or, you know, and that's kind of the fundamental thing in this book.
Yeah. I do want to get into it a little bit more with you later around karma and I don't think it's the right word, the mystic part, but certainly the reincarnation part or the past life part. And this is, to me, one of the most important things that anyone who wants to become free of these habitual patterns, of these hindrances, honesty. And you talk about our thousands of decisions to wear blinders instead of inquiring with honest awareness into both the beauty and the pain of our daily lives, absolutely necessary. Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that, because without that, no mindfulness or anything is going to do a damn thing.
That's right. You know, the mind wants to create this separation, right? Where there's this little corner of the room where we can say, yeah, awareness, presence, you know, mindfulness practice, but not this. I'm going to keep this for me, and I got this. And that self-deception, you know, which, you know, that is the thing that I think, you know, particularly for those of us as meditators, you know, and many others have talked about this as well, we can harness meditation and actually can become a hindrance in and of itself, that we're deceiving ourselves, that we are doing this.
Yeah, the bypass.
Yeah. And so I think that's a key thing. I know I continue to unfold to that and to see that self-protective closing where I need to own this, I need to possess this, you know. And so to me, it felt very important when I was writing this to, you know, it is this willingness to open, and I needed to be open when I wrote this, and not at all deign to have some sort of state that I sustain at all time. You know, most people these days don't do that much, at least in my reading. And yet I wanted to overtly display that, you know, I'm as hindered as anyone at times. And I think that just helps me to hear that from someone that I'm receiving something from, or I'm learning from.
Yeah. I got that in spades. As you know, this is Ram Dass's inspired podcast network. And that was when I first met him a long time back. that was one of the most immediate and powerful transmissions that I got from him as a teacher. Honesty. Yeah. He was
honest.
And because he was absolutely honest about everything. And in fact, in the very beginning, it was, okay, it's okay. All right. I have these thoughts and I have these judgments about myself and whatever else. It's okay. We all got them, you know. So, right. Yeah, honesty. And that's
brutally so if we're willing.
Yeah. Now, that's the other thing. If we are willing, and courage is something else that you do bring up. And I think that is very, very important, so that we don't, put that awareness in a closet of our true motivations and so on. So, courage. So, five hindrances. All listeners be good to be informed here. What are the five hindrances? And you've put them in a bit of a more secular kind of a thing, but.
Yeah, I'm want to do that. You know, I like to put my own spin on things. You know, no disrespect to others, but I like acronyms. I'm kind of like Dan Siegel that way. I like to create acronyms for practices, and I wanted to take these, sloth and torpor, which is one of the hindrances, is often confusing to people. So that sparked me to think, well, what are other words I could use? And W words came to mind. So, the first traditionally is desire. And so I renamed that, wanting. And then I really felt it was important to make the distinction with that hindrance, just in a nutshell, that, I think it gets a bad rap, or at least the Buddhist approach to desire as a thing that can cloud the mind can get a bad rap, that the Buddha was trying to say we should squash any desire from our body mind. And people like Mark Epstein, psychiatrist, and his writing on that, in his one book, Opening to Desire, was really helpful to me in writing this book. That's not what the Buddha intends. That's not what you actually encounter as you practice. Desire is part of the body mind. It lets us know that things are worth reaching toward. It's the craving aspect. It's the compulsive aspect. It's the, I have to have this, where we're grabbing at it and forcing at it without awareness. That's where the suffering comes from. So that, this is a, I think it's front and center in traditional teaching, because all of these are universal, but we feel desire every day. We want.
We
every
do.
Day. Yep.
Oh.
I did 20 minutes ago and got my iced coffee from Dunkin' Donuts.
What you've done, Mitch, is okay. You just said, I got my iced coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, and now I'm thinking, shit, I got to get over to Starbucks. That's my thought, even though we're in the middle of a podcast. So
that's right.
God,
that's right.
Talk about it's, karma.
We cue each other.
Yeah, and, major.
I think it's really powerful. Desire's okay. It's okay to experience the pleasure of an iced coffee, unless you have serious health issues, it would say, don't drink caffeine, don't have, this stuff. But if there's nothing like that and you're able to hold it lightly, it's here, I'm experiencing this coffee-esque-ness and it's nice, but it's the trying to force it to stay. It's the gotta have it now.
Yeah, addictive.
Yeah, that's what leads to the rampant craving, the addiction. Mm-hmm. Judd Brewer's work on meditation and the neuroscience of craving, I think is huge to kind of help people who might benefit from the scientific take on this hindrance. But I mean, all five of these were traditionally taught, you know, to monastics, that it's important if you want to continue on the path of awakening to encounter each of these body-mind states that will hinder your ability to see clearly. And then traditionally in the Pali Canon, the Buddha refers to this metaphor of the pool of water, and that in various different ways, metaphorically, each of these five hindering patterns clouds our clear seeing, you know, through this pool, and you know, desire definitely clouds us. So I think there's a reason why it's listed first in terms of how frequently and intensely we experience that as a blockade to awareness.
And then you, I love how, I mean, anger is, of course, the next one that you talk about. And but you referred to it, which I thought, yeah, this is a great word, hostility.
Yeah. Because it's, I think in Joseph Goldstein's work, and you know, and many others, you know, aversion is a word that gets used, and you know, sometimes people just say anger, but I think that can kind of miss something or lead to misconception. Hostility seemed to capture it well for me, but you know, and then the W word I use is wrestling, you know, and I like that in the sense that we're wanting to wrestle to the ground the sense of it shouldn't be this way.
Yeah.
And it has this angry, hostile push, pull, tug of war aspect to it.
Defending ourselves. And
yeah.
Wronged. We are wronged. So we are, wrestle that stuff down.
I can't have this and I'm blaming you.
Yeah. Right. So it's a great word. And then sloth and torpor, although it is archaic. It sounds right, sloth and torpor.
Yeah, it's onomatopoetic.
Yeah, it is. But certainly, what have you used? Sluggishness is something you use. Yeah, so that's a slug. Everybody, you feel like a slug today. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, and in terms of meditation, it's less around, you know, many of us when we feel sluggish, or the W word here is wilting. You know, when we have that wilting aspect, it could be from a much more pure physiologic reason in terms of we haven't slept enough, or we ate something, or we haven't eaten, you know, that kind of, or you have a medical condition. And yet what I think this is pointing to is more the sense of mental wilting or sluggishness that may not have a direct physiological or medical cause. It's more of a psychological cause that we don't want to be in this experience now. And so we find ourselves clouding over, and our mind just is not working. We can't think, you know, clearly. I've had it happen many times with clients who, for HIPAA reasons and my own embarrassment, I will, you know, not name, but where I've sat with them and I find myself wilting. And it's not that I'm sleepy per se, like I just, you know, I need a nap. It's that I'm quote unquote bored. And my mind is getting, you know, it's dull. It feels like I'm walking through something thick. And if you can bring mindfulness to that, and curiosity to that without the judgment, you know, then you might actually start to realize, like in the role of a therapist, what is it about this moment with this person that I'm not wanting to have? And it might be that they're raising something, or they're displaying something that's hitting my karma, that's hitting my stuff, and I'm wilting away from it and tuning out. And so then that's valuable data. And when you can get into that space, then you actually start to wake up a bit.
Yeah.
And then you can engage. And, you know, and I think I tell a story in the book about a patient I had years ago where I did this and I tuned out. And then you know, as often happens with these hindrances, they feed on each other and they interact with each other. And then anger came in for me that she's making me look incompetent because she's not changing. So the dullness was there, the sloth and torpor, the wilting, but then also this hostility. And so then I forced, you know, cognitive, behavioral, research-based, all good stuff, methods at her. And, you know, because I felt like she was just whining and complaining and I was checked out. And so I said, this is what we're doing. You're going to do this and then things are going to get better. And then she dropped out of therapy. I never saw her again. Versus if I could have found a way to get curious and kind of own my own kind of, I'm not sure where to go next with this. My mind's kind of jello over here. Maybe we would have creatively co-created a new path. I don't know.
Wonderful example. And everybody, you know, we all do this. We don't have to be therapists. For everybody we sit down and pay some attention to, a friend's story, a coworker, a parent, a child. And the minute that you, and I am, by the way, talk about honesty, I am a prime offender here in terms of drifting and getting ADD for whatever reason. And I love what you just said. Yeah, somebody may be hitting me in the place where that's triggering habitual patterns and past karmic stuff, or whatever. And I don't want to deal with that. And I'm either getting ADD-ness or a little bit of sleepiness or bored, you know, whatever. And, you know, there was somebody who said once, the most generous thing that you can do with another human being, it's a great quote from a famous person, I can't remember who, but I do remember the quote, is be the most generous thing that you can offer to another human being is total attention.
Yeah.
And yeah. And working, so this is a great way to work through this, to see, okay, there, this isn't out of a void why I'm either, I'm getting completely sidetracked, tired, feeling angry, whatever it may be, and to, and use that self-examination mindfulness. So yeah, very good.
It's always, it's all, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, we all inter are, and, you know, as a therapist, it ain't about them having a diagnosis and that they have a problem. You know, when they come in here, we're in this field of awareness together. And, you know, if I'm getting triggered, I'm helping create that. There's something in me that is not wanting to have what is.
Great. I just start thinking about, because many people, we have these retreats in Maui with Ram Dass and Jack and others. And many people, not many people, but it happens fairly often because Ram Dass was a psychologist in his Harvard days. They say, what do you think about working with a therapist? And Ram Dass always says, if he thinks he's a therapist, don't do it. If he's not going to be, as you just said, in that one continuum that we are in together, working together,
right,
then that's a whole other thing. So I'm really glad to hear that.
That I like to say to audiences when I'm in, they tend to, I talk to a lot of clinicians when I do talks, and I'll have them raise their hands. How many of you have either about yourself or others in the field, referred to being a change agent, an agent of change? And, you know, everybody raises their hands, and I'll look at everybody and say, bullshit. Yeah, you are not an agent of change, nor am I. At best, you arrange certain conditions, and if you let go of trying to make that change happen via agency, that's actually where the most closest thing to quote unquote mastery happens. And there are no therapists. There are just people encountering stuff. And, you know, we help each other create certain conditions where things can spark and we can be more aware.
You may get a lot of calls here after we put your website up there, Mitch. Also, oh, well, we haven't finished. We have worry.
And yes.
Of course, that's, we don't have to say much about worry. Is it called restlessness traditionally
the English translation is restlessness. And I call it worrying. It's that this is where I think the mind is leaning out down the track saying, what's that around the corner? And it could be like what it clearly looks like anxiety. It could be like what you were saying earlier, that ADHD aspect, that I can't be in this. I got to be over here, and the grass is greener experience. And things get distracted, things get impulsive, and the mind is future leaning. As I like to say to kids, instead of texting, what's really going on is you're nexting. Your mind is constantly leaning into the next thing. And what about now? What's happening now that matters to you? That's the essence of restlessness.
Yeah. I think I need some therapy. My mother just worried from the beginning of her life to the end of her life. Well, actually, until she got dementia. It's funny, dementia, then no worries. She was in the moment. It's weird what happens with that disease. But I'm always mom, you did this to me. I worry. I mean, and I'm the only difference is after all this work over these decades, spiritual work, I'm not chasing it, and I'm not vibing with it the way that anywhere near the way I used to, and she did. But talk about the karma and the patterns that get created through how we get brought up and who we are with. It's extraordinary.
Right. And that's a really important point, by the way, that when others bump up against us with their karma, we will feel that restlessness. We'll feel the desire to change that in them, to be that change agent. Yeah. And so the depth of this kind of work, this kind of karmic work, is you keep remembering via acceptance that this want, this desire, it's in me. And I can watch it. I can let it be. I can notice and allow. And I can't change that for them. That's their journey. That's their path. Yeah. I can hold up my truth, that like, hey, I'm over here and I see things differently. And yet, you have yours right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And the last, but not the least.
No.
Doubt, which is, you could do a book just on that and the myriad ways in which doubt expresses itself. Oh, boy.
Yeah, I'm not remembering off the top of my head. I think I cite someone in the book as saying that it may have been Joseph Goldstein that doubt is the killer of the hindrances that, my way of thinking about it, it's very close in. Things like hostility, we can put it out here and I know that's a pattern. I know that is not me, or I need to relate to this differently. But doubt is so laden with I can't, or this won't work out for me, that it feels like it's us. And of the hindrances, it just grabs all the others and pulls them in. So it's kind of like the quarterback of the hindrances.
I like that. It sure is. Oh my. And you talk about when we work with working with the hindrances, you say, is basically a working through of one's conditioned karmic patterns.
Yeah.
And that's an essence-y statement. And it really is the bottom line for all of our work. For we do a thing here called life in balance. I mean, that's our kind of byword of helping us all get into a life in balance. And that is absolutely the primary, is to get after these karmic conditioned patterns and so on. In terms of karma, And you say you don't need to have any mystical relationship with that word. You don't need to, we're not going to get into reincarnation, past lives, and so on. But I do think it is important, actually. And I know that can be very tough for people because we just don't come from a culture that has that no. Whatsoever. And right. Only through absolute grace was I introduced to that when I went to India with Ram Dass and met this incredible being named Karoli Baba. But then I did experience that, the reality of that. And then since then I have seen it's become transparent in some ways, just how these things do come not just from this present life, and that there is a purpose in that way for us to work through them. So I know that I get what you did, Mitch, with the book and getting into it in the way that you did, but maybe you can just mention to me what you do think yourself personally of that aspect of karma.
Well, I'll be brutally honest. I'm working on that. You know, I'm working on my own pushback. I'll say this, you know, please give my regards to Ram Dass. I haven't met him, but he's had a massive influence on me indirectly. And he should know, he already, I'm sure, knows this, you know, that documentary of his, you know, Fierce Grace. Yeah. I refer to one segment in particular over and over again with patients of mine, you know, the Rachel's Letter segment.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
and that brings me back to this, you know, the karma in terms of, you know, rebirth and, you know, purpose carrying forward. You know what he wrote to those parents around that the tragic death of their child was her gift to them, and you know, few people could stay conscious to that amount of pain. And yet are they willing to stay open, and then receive that gift, you know, from their daughter, and then in that loving openness, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but meet her again and again and again and truly know one another. And so I've known the truth of that. And yet I can't explain it in terms of my mind's understanding of how a purpose weaves across, quote unquote, time. I think it's a mental enigma. And yet I experientially, you know, like even now, know that there's this truth that my mind can't understand. And maybe with an experience of that purpose arriving, re-arriving, I will understand more. I think that's the most that I can say with words about that.
Mm. Well said, Mitch, really. And, you know, and the truth is, and this is, I'll read from the book, actually, because I think this is really what I believe this is invaluable. And that you absolutely do, I agree with you, you do not need to believe in reincarnation, past lives, any of that. And here's, the essence of karma is that actions determine experience. Actions based on reactive patterns reinforce patterns and lead to suffering. Actions based on attention in presence dismantle patterns and lead to opening. When we understand how behavior affects experience, we understand karma. And you say here, belief in past and future lifetimes isn't an issue. And I agree. Appreciation of karma does not come from intellectual understanding or belief. It comes from seeing directly how patterns in conditioning operate, a seeing that comes about only through cultivating attention in uncovering awareness. So, yeah. Well said, and right in that.
Thank you. I think a chunk of that, you, if you have the book in front of you, yeah, I don't. is I'm quoting Ken McClure.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Ken, meditation in Tibetan.
Yes,
you are.
Who
cares? It's all us, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But I, you know, and he actually told me on the phone. He's like, you know, be careful talking a lot about karma because it's so. but I agree with you. You know, I wanted to raise it at all in this book because I think it's so important for people to understand and then experience. More importantly, we have to unfold into our patterns and we need to not try and control them, push them away, change them. But our lives open most and we're happiest, not through some 7-step method that's going to last forever, but by turning into the things that are uncomfortable and opening.
Yeah. So. By the way, talking about, you mentioned in the book, loving awareness. Ram Dass has got that trademark, Mitch. I don't know. Did you ask him? No, it's funny because years ago, Ram Dass has this whole loving awareness talk and meditation. Or getting people to get out of their heads, ego, mind stuff, and get into a center, the true place inside us, in the center of our, wherever. And by, I am loving awareness. I am loving awareness. And then just loving aware, and just creating that presence. And
you know, heart, mind, the illusion thereof, but loving awareness.
Yeah. And, he puts it, you know, just get out of there completely.
That's right.
The mind, you know, that awareness, it mm-hmm. is like a joint venture here with the love. But interesting. So, and of course, all of our Buddhist friends, loving kindness is the practice. And now they're all going out doing loving awareness. And then I read it in your book. It's just going on.
Hey, cite the source.
Yeah.
I tried to do that as much as I can.
No, I'm sure you didn't even think for a minute. You probably never even heard that. It's just coming into the general consciousness through osmosis of some other sort.
That's right.
Hey, tell this story though, Mitch. It's so great. And I have heard it before. I don't know. It's the Mahatma Gandhi story. You say, keep me awake to the truth of karma to consider this anecdote. Tell that story. It's great.
Yeah. So I'm going to paraphrase it here, but, a mother brings her young child, to Gandhi and says, you know, please get him to stop eating sugar. And, you know, Gandhi says, okay, well go away and come back in 2 days. So she comes back in 2 days and she's like, why did you send, you know, he's like, you know, how can I help you understand this? So why did you send me away? Well, I needed you to go away because I needed to stop eating sugar first.
Yeah.
You know, I'm paraphrasing, you know, but
yeah.
he knew, he's like, I can't tell them to stop a pattern if, you know, I've got that pattern in me.
Yeah. And which is and you say if Gandhi can acknowledge it and open amid his less than ideal karmic conditioning, so can we. And that is it's possible. Everybody, we can cut through our conditioning and our habitual patterns that really lead to these hindrances. Absolutely, 100%. And of course, and this is something in the book that is very much a gigantic suggestion. We might consider meditation as a way to start moving into an awareness that can really help cut through this stuff. You say it's the mirror that accurately reflects how each of the five hindrances is warping, basically warping our asses. That's what's happening.
That's right.
So, talk about that and your own experience, how that's helped you.
Yeah, I think in my direct willingness to open, things go best, but not necessarily without pain when there's this willingness to see things as they are, almost like, you know, I think in the book I call it, you know, awareness like a mirrored bowl. And when we first start practicing, you know, many of us, most of us, it starts like almost like a thimble. We can't hold very much. But as we keep showing up to opening to whatever is, be it pain or, you know, possibility, that bowl widens. And yet, you know, we can never control what shows up in it. And, I continue to have a lot of crap show up in my bowl, as do all of us. It's like, you know, okay, I see you. I can relate to you. I can work with you. And my life goes better personally when I don't try and shove you away. So I, you know, this book has been so much of a wake up call to me as I wrote it. And, but I do think it's kind of helped set the stage for my own journey, which is what ultimately makes writing so important to me.
Yeah. Well, everything you're doing is just absolutely contributing to the sharing of your heart and fixing your heart and sharing that. And whoever, you know, it's their karma to get that the way that they're supposed to, then wonderful, right? So it's a great thing. So one of the other things that I've been working on with some of the teachers, and, you know, we do online courses about different things and so on. And one of them is that I'm working on right now is about basically how we get from the story of me, or what it's Krishnadas, a good friend of mine, calls, wake up in the morning with the movie of me.
Yeah.
And you're the starring role. In fact, that's you're right. All the roles. And how do we transform that into the story of us? And you've been saying some things that are exactly that. But I'm just thinking, talk about just dealing with it, because you're dealing with that day to day. You'll be dealing with it soon. I know we have to get off here because you're going to be talking to somebody
in a few minutes.
But just a little bit around dealing with that story we continuously reinforce our existence as that big self, I, me.
I think that's where the money is. You know, I'm already toying with my next endeavor, and I see there's like this continuum around meditation, mindfulness practice, and the we. And you know, most of us, you know, most people, most of the time, they feel unseen. And then they occasionally feel seen, kind of moving across the continuum, but in an egoic sense. You see this separate me over here and I'm awesome, or that's great that you see me. And then with practice or conditions, whether there's formal meditation practice or not, but for most of us, we need that form and structure. There is seeing. So unseen, seen, seeing. And then I feel like it's really important. This is what the next thing is I want to write, is with enough seeing when we're in the field with another, and this is where me as a therapist and a dad and a husband, we can be prizing another. So it's this compassionate, it's this willing, honest, compassionate seeing the what is seems to be arising in another and speaking to it. So it's not praise. It's like, hey, I see you over there as best as I can, and I see you risking, I see you opening in whatever way you are, and that matters to me, that touches me, versus, hey, good job, here's a cookie. You know, and I think when we prize one another, we're eyeing that thing in them that is opening, that is awakening. And as a therapist, when I intervene from that space, I'm not trying to change them. There's no agenda. You know, prizing is like a compassionate gift of awareness in the interpersonal field. And it's one of the core conditions that opens that body mind to going from unseen to seen to seeing themselves. So to me, that feels important to talk about, that it's less of like a seven-step method, but there's like this growing thing that can happen with growing awareness, that it's not just about being on a cushion and being aware of our senses and our thoughts. It's then turning out into the world and saying, you know, you and I see you, and what I see in you really matters to me and changes me, affects me. I think that's the we aspect of meditation.
Mm, love it. I love the word prize. I've never prizing somebody.
Yes.
Yeah. That kind of reaching out, just the reaching out and having that compassionate feeling and the embrace, the vibrational embrace, prizing somebody. That's great.
Versus praising. Praising can feel like it has an agenda. I mean, this is coming out of all these years of working with kids with emotional behavioral disorders and knowing through lots of stubbed toes that when I try and control this kid's behavior, I might be able to get them to stop in the moment, but it doesn't lead to real shifts for them. And yet when I look at them and say something like, dude, this is the last thing you wanted to have happen today. And yet, peekaboo, I see you behind that behavior. And what I see in there is worth showing up to. You let me know if you're willing to show up to me. Mm-hmm. And that's prizing a kid and not buying into the story of their quote-unquote problem behavior. Time and time again, I've seen kids open and be willing to risk. And I think that's contagious. I think prizing, it helps people see and it helps people prize others. So,
yeah, it's wonderful. Wonderful, Mitch. I love it. I am going to borrow that concept, somehow. Okay.
Hey,
I'll give you credit though, for sure. The Five Hurdles to Happiness is a wonderful book, and there's so many other things in here that I go through a book and I go, oh yeah, that's interesting. I want to talk about that. And of course, there's just not enough time to do it all. What about we're going to have on Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network, we have a show notes page, and of course, we're going to link the book. And what about a URL so people could catch up with you? Is that?
Yeah, it's www.drmitchablett.com.
Okay, great. And where are you?
I'm in Boston.
You're in Boston. Okay.
Yes. Live in Newton.
Oh, that's right. That's in the book. Yes. So there you go. All of you guys and gals in Boston, he's available. If I was there, I'd be going, okay? Great to meet you. Great to talk to you. And we look forward to continuing this conversation again.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. So this is Mind Rolling on the Be Here Now Network. We'll see you next week.